Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same-day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. It happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.
Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. Ahn, clinical sexologist, with Xander Kegg, licensed social worker. Xander will be introducing our guest this hour.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ahn, and hello, everyone. Our guest today is Veronica Zare, also known as Ronnie. So I'll be referring to Veronica as Ronnie throughout the show today. Ronnie is the author of Memoirs, A Cold Warrior, a novel. She retired from the U.S. Army in 1998 after over 22 years of active duty and reserve service. While in the Army, she held various U.S. and overseas assignments at the battalion, brigade, and division levels with the Army's 1st and 35th Infantry Divisions. She is a graduate of Kansas State University and also courses at the U.S. Army's Command and General Staff College. In her civilian career, she managed a homeless shelter, a home maintenance program that kept seniors in their home, and was a development director for a nonprofit agency. She was the tribal grant writer for the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation in Kansas. She is a past board president of Trans Family Support Services. She is currently a co-chair for the San Diego LGBT Center Veterans Wall of Honor, a program honoring the military service of local LGBT citizens. And very recently, Ronnie was appointed by Governor Gavin Newsom to the California Veterans Board. Welcome to the Umbrella Hour, Ronnie.
Thank you so much for having me, Xander and Dr. Ahn.
You are very welcome. So I always like to let the audience know when I know the guest personally. And I do know Ronnie. Ronnie and I go back several years when I lived in Southern California. And I'm also a veteran. I've spoken about that before. And so we know each other from the trans veteran community. And in addition, we're both up on the LGBT Center's Wall of Honor in San Diego. So we have that in common. So being a transgender veteran, there's so many different places we can go with that topic. I would really love to hear your thoughts. What do you have to say about this topic of being a transgender veteran that our audience it would be helpful for them to hear from you?
Well, number one, I want to emphasize the fact that I'm a veteran first and I'm transgender second. When you're in the military, you're part of something bigger than yourself. And in very many respects, it was that identity, I guess you could say, that kept me going for so many years while I was dealing with being transgender, because it allowed me to focus more on something other than just being transgender. Because I think a lot of us who are trans, we have this white noise almost in the back of our minds that are constantly saying, what you see in the mirror is not who you are. What you see in the mirror is not who you are. And by being in the military, it helped me basically keep that white noise and that chatter, that gender chatter, out of my head and all of that. So that's what I would like to emphasize. Also, just I am an American, and it's my duty to help defend and support the Constitution of the United States. And it's something that I firmly believe in, and it's something that I believe everyone should be allowed to participate in, so long as they meet the requirements to be in.
When I served in the U.S. Coast Guard, it was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell was enacted. I served in the late 1980s. Don't Ask, Don't Tell went into effect either late 1993 or early 1994. And so when I was serving, technically I wasn't supposed to be serving, right? As a trans man, I was a
Correct.
lesbian when I was serving in the military, and so we were barred from service, even though there were gay and lesbian and trans people who just weren't transitioned or transitioning serving in the military then and for years up to that. And so I had somebody ask me, why would you serve in the military if the military didn't want you? And I said, like you said, you're a veteran first and a trans person second. It was the same thing for me. I was a patriotic person first, and serving in the military was what I wanted to do since I was a child, having been raised by a father who served in the Marine Corps. And the fact that at the time I was a lesbian was secondary to me. I don't know that people who are part of the LGBT community who have never served in the military and haven't been around the military, I don't think they understand that kind of commitment. Have you experienced that yourself in conversation with people?
I have experienced the level of commitment amongst other veterans that have served that are trans as well. We have more in common with straight veterans a lot of the times than we do with people that are transgender who have never served. I'll give you an example. Last Wednesday, a week ago, I was scheduled for jury duty. The judge asks everyone, well, tell us a little bit about yourself. And of course, when they got to me, I had to mention I came from Kansas. I grew up on a farm, that kind of thing. And there was another man in the jury pool that was from Kansas, and he had served in the military just like I had. And we hit it off amazingly well. And here he is, some straight man that probably never met a trans person before. And we hit it off, but we had that instantaneous something that we could talk about, which was membership in the military. I guess you could say we were both tribal members of the same tribe, as Sebastian Younger points out in his book, Tribe.
I like that. Before we started recording, you had mentioned to Dr. An and I that there are three things that all trans people, or at least all most trans people, or a lot of trans people, I'm not exactly sure how to say that, want. And I'd love for you to tell the listeners what you were saying about that.
Well, I transitioned almost 25 years ago now, in December of 1998. And three things that I've noticed for every trans person that I've met and that I've interacted with since then is that we want three basic things out of life. We want to provide for our families. The second thing is we want to be valued co-workers. And the third thing is we just want to be respected members of our neighborhoods and communities.
Those three things are true for me as well. So I appreciate you saying that.
I think that the trans community, especially here in America right now, is being maligned a little bit and accused of having an agenda. Well, if we have an agenda, that's it. To provide, to be valued coworkers, and to be respected members of our communities. That's our
That's
agenda.
I agree. Only to a certain extent. And what I mean by that is, I agree that that is most likely the majority perspective within the trans community. I do think that we unfortunately have some members of our community, the trans community, who want some very different, very radical things that are upsetting people on the quote other side of us. And that the amount of traction that they've gained through social media makes it seem like that's what we all want. I think that's what you mean by the agenda. It is a small group of people within the trans community that are pushing a pretty outrageous agenda from my viewpoint. And I think it gets placed on all of us. We all have that, but I think that that's what other people, that's what they're hearing. And so that's what they think about all of us. And that's unfortunate.
Oh, I agree. I would agree with you on that.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of changes come about just within the last, I would say, and I don't know if you agree with this, Xander, or not, in the last couple of years, especially where we live in the Southeast. And now I've traveled elsewhere. I've traveled to the Midwest, and I've certainly traveled to California back and forth, but I particularly feel it here, and less so than Orlando. I think Orlando has a predominantly fairly large LGBTQ community. We have a community here, but it's a lot smaller. And I don't know if it's for that reason that we see a lot of pushback within our community that sometimes distorts what some of us are after.
I think it's similar to other places that the urban-rural differences are at play, and there's a lot of rural areas in Florida. And so you mentioned Orlando, where I live, and it's a very urban or suburban place. But Florida is made up of a lot of farmland and horse ranches. And I don't think people know how variable, you know, this state is. And again, I think that small minority of people within the LGBTQ community or the trans community or the QT or TQ community, there's all different ways that people talk about it. Their messaging is being selectively yanked out and then thrown back at us in a way that is, I think, meant to shut us all down. That's going to resonate in places where, in the South in particular, I think, because it's a bit more conservative, in the Midwest where it's more conservative. So I think that's why it's happening in Florida. Where you live on is, you're outside of an urban area. So it's not rural, of course, but it is outside.
It's very touristy. I think at times that's what spares us too, though, because we see a lot of diversity, but it's not necessarily diversity of individuals who live here. It's diversity in the sense that people travel here and we see people from all over the world and all different backgrounds.
Ronnie, I'm wondering, as a person who served for many years in the Army, as on both active duty and also in the reserve units, I'm curious if there's anything you'd like to talk about. We don't need to take up a whole lot of time with it if you don't want to, but I'd love for people to be able to hear your ideas or your opinions or your perspective, maybe that's more appropriate, on what's going on right now, for example, in Ukraine, if you'd like to voice in on that.
From a military perspective, what I would observe is that this drives home the whole issue of, we have ourselves full-scale total war almost on our hands between two powers, Ukraine and Russia. And a lot of individuals, just a month before the war began back last year, I remember reading an article about, is the tank dead? And this whole experience in the past year has taught us completely otherwise. Also, but from a standpoint of what I said earlier about a total war between Ukraine and Russia, especially with Ukraine is mobilizing everybody that they can to fight the war. They have mobilized bakers, they've mobilized cooks, they've mobilized busboys and busgirls, waitresses and waiters, to move into uniform to be able to fight off the invasion. And along with that, they've increased their numbers of LGBT service personnel as well. And from all the reports that I can see right now, the LGBT community in Ukraine has actually gained a great deal of respect from their countrymen, because they've been willing to go ahead and put on the uniform and train and learn how to fight and all. So I think what this is proving is that in a time when the nation, when the society needs as many people to step up and support it as possible, then LGBT people are not going to be thrown out. And that in turn, for us, can leverage asks later on of the government, such as, well, we help you out during your time of need. Just make sure you don't pass any laws that are going to discriminate and disenfranchise us. That's going to have some positive results for the LGBT community in Ukraine down the road.
Well, that's very interesting. I was unaware of that. I appreciate you talking about that. And I would imagine our listeners are going to be also appreciative of that. On, was there something you wanted to ask?
In Israel, everyone has to serve in the military once they're 18. And so males enter, and it's for about 32 months. And then females enter, but it's for less time. Do you think that in our country, in the U.S., it would be a productive process for youth who graduate from high school to enter in the military to gain some of that insight and teamwork, to be able to work collaboratively among others before they go out and experience life outside of the military?
I do. I'm a big believer in national service. And I don't think that service has to be completely military in order to be termed national. I believe that everyone has a talent that they can contribute. No matter how humble they may appear, they have a talent. And it's up to them to find out what that talent is. And very often people don't find out what their true talents are until they're confronted with something they're forced to do, such as participate in a jury pool, for example. We don't really ask our citizens to do much of anything other than submit to jury service and all of that and to pay taxes. We don't even make people vote, for crying out loud. But I'm of the opinion that we should be asking our young people to put 2 years into something like the national service. And the military service does not necessarily have to be all active. It could be you're drafted into the National Guard or the reserves. You go to boot camp, you go to your service school, and then you're released to your part-time unit where you become a citizen soldier for the remainder of your two-year time. But if somebody doesn't want to be drafted into the Army or to the Navy, they can say, well, wait a minute, I don't want to do that, but I can work in a hospital and I can help clean equipment because hospitals constantly need upkeep and care. So I see no reason why for those who want to pursue national service from an other than military commitment, that they could do that through Job Corps, through Civilian Conservation Corps. I hope that makes sense, but I think it would be instructive and it would build character because I don't think that Americans get enough civics education. And I do know that in boot camp, the first thing they tell you in boot camp is they give you a history lesson about your service, whether it's the Navy, the Coast Guard, or the Army, or the Air Force.
No, I wholeheartedly agree with you, Ronnie. I am a big supporter of conscription, right? Compulsory service. I also agree. It doesn't have to be military. You mentioned Conservation Corps. You mentioned Job Corps. I used to work for Job Corps. I love Job Corps. I think that's a wonderful program. And it's similar in the sense that you live on site, you're issued a uniform, you're trained in a vocation. And also VISTA, right? VISTA is the U.S. Peace Corps, so to speak. And even, you know, for conscientious objectors who don't want to do military service, these are options. I was a conscientious objector when I served in the U.S. Coast Guard. There's two different kinds, those who serve in the military and those who serve in some sort of parallel. I think it should be. And I agree that it's character building. I was 20 years old when I went off to basic training. I was, as a 20-year-old, so directionless. Mm-hmm. And it gave me direction. It also taught me how to channel all of my angst into leadership. And it helped me develop my leadership skills. And it also gave me a trade, and then it launched me into whatever I was going to do after I left the service. So there are so many benefits from that. Definitely.
We're seeing many of the youth having difficulty with emotional regulation, as well as building resilience. And never before have I ever witnessed, I'm 68, have I ever witnessed a lack of interplay among children, especially young children on the streets or at parks. What I do see is a lot of arrangements centered around sports. There's nothing wrong with sports by any means. I'm a full advocate for sports. It's people healthy, and it's a good way for kids to build bones and their muscles, including their brain muscles. But because we have a lot of helicopter parents, and maybe that goes back to the piece of the missing children and all the efforts of organizations looking for missing children and individuals who have gone missing, leaving with boyfriends and what have you. Maybe some of that has a piece in it. And again, I'm not faulting them. I think we need them because we do have those issues. I also see this lack of interplay. And while it may take place over gaming, and there's a whole different world in of itself, and I can appreciate that, I just don't see a lot of what somebody at my age, and we did a lot of street play, visiting kids even in other neighborhoods, and sometimes getting into spats with them and then having to work those out. And our parents were never involved, ever. And so it was a whole different time element as well. And so I'm conscientious about that also. But also in raising my own kids, I have three sons, and remembering very clearly they interacted with other kids on the basketball court or at the schoolyard or the park. And a lot of times I really had no idea what they were doing. And that didn't make me a hands-off parent. It just meant they had their world and they could interact and play. And they gained a lot of insight as a result of that. And in fact, my sons to this day have friendships from when they were kids. They still have those friendships. We are going to take our first commercial break. In case you are just joining us, we are meeting with Veronica Zare. In her civilian career, Veronica managed a homeless shelter and a home maintenance program that kept seniors in their homes, and she was a development director for a nonprofit agency. Veronica was also the tribal grant writer for the prairie band Potawatomi Nation in Kansas. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
In case you are just joining us now, this is the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour is Veronica Zier. Veronica has held various U.S. and overseas assignments at the battalion, brigade, and division levels with the Army's 1st and 35th Infantry Divisions. She is a graduate of Kansas State University and courses at the U.S. Army's Command General Staff College. We left off talking about children who lack social interaction with other peers, as perhaps some of us were fortunate enough to experience playing on the streets, at playgrounds, maybe on school grounds, opposed to organized, structured play as we're seeing a lot of these days. Let's pick up where we left off.
On what that makes me think of is, I think it was within the last year, I remember reading an article about how few young people in the United States are even eligible for military service. It's such a small number, percentage-wise, of young people who would meet criteria to enter into military service for a number of reasons, having mental health diagnoses, being on prescription psychotropic medications for mental illness, overweight, being overweight, doing very poorly in school, not being able to get a high enough score on the entrance exam for military service. I think this is a real issue that the military is having to deal with right now. Have you read anything about that, or you know about that, Ronnie?
I have. The Army and the Navy have missed their recruiting goals for the last 2 years, I believe. The other service that's having a bit of a problem is the Air Force. The Marines seem to be holding steady. Space Force, they get a lot of their people out of elsewhere anyway. Coast Guard is small enough. They've really not had much of a problem. But it's also probably the one service that has a bona fide mission that as soon as you leave boot camp, your mission is going to be. It's going out to sea and checking on a ship that's approaching the shores, to put it simply. Those are a couple of the reasons why recruitment has suffered, is because of the amount of young people that just cannot qualify for the military. And I want to echo something that Dr. On said, is that the resilience of the youth in this country does seem to be very weak right now at this point. I'm a big fan of Nassim Taleb. He wrote the book, The Black Swan, and he also wrote a book called Anti-Fragility. And it seems that it's almost like a fractal in nature, is that you can almost represent the brittleness of a society through something common. And that something common that runs through our society all the way up to Wall Street very often can be brittleness of the people that make up those institutions and all of that. If I could explain it just a little bit further and define it just a little bit more clearly, I would liken it to a cracker, okay? A cracker crumbles at the slightest bit of pressure. And I think what we want is we want to build people that have the consistency of a cracker, but the resiliency of hardtack. Excuse me, not consistency of a cracker, but if they're like a cracker, they're almost like hardtack instead. very resilient to breakage.
In my well-being workshops, when I'm talking about emotion regulation and distress tolerance, and what I say to people is, resilience is the concept of, let's say, the phoenix rising out of the ashes, right? Something happens, it breaks us down, it tears us down, it flattens us, whatever. It knocks us off our footing, so to speak. And then over a period of time, we get back up, we build back up to where we were. We basically were taken down, we stand up again, we move on. And anti-fragility is more like the Hydra. You cut off one head and two pop out. It's that you get stronger. The adversity, you don't bounce back from it. You grow from it. You blossom. You strengthen as a result of that adversity. And it really is a big difference. It's like we can cultivate resiliency. And I think that there was a trend of doing that with instituting social emotional learning in our schools. Unfortunately, in the summer of 2020, they redid the SEL curriculum, and it no longer provides that emotional intelligence, quote, building, right? The EQ building components that it once had. And I think that the result of that going forward, we're going to see, unfortunately, the results of not developing emotional intelligence or resiliency in kids. And so anti-fragility is something that is above and beyond this resiliency. And so we have to have a certain foundation. And maybe that's what we're lacking in that foundation. I've heard, going back to what An was saying about the kind of parenting that he provided, right? The kind of parenting that was provided to him. There's a person, I forget her name right now, but she wrote a book and there's a webpage dedicated to free range parenting. This concept of letting your kids, like I'm a Gen Xer. So I basically was told to go outside and play and to not come back until much later. And I unsupervised when I grew up with no seatbelts and metal play toys at the playground in the parks with concrete underneath us half the time. So there was a sense in which, starting from very young in our life, we were introduced to resiliency because we had to learn how to deal with these scuffles and how to bang up our knees and get up and brush them off and go back to playing. And that's what's missing because of that, more of the coddling of the children or the helicopter parenting, or I've also heard it referred to as bulldozer parenting, where you're basically just pushing every adversity out of the way so the child never has to deal with adversity. And that's very handicapping for young people as they go into their adult years. They don't have enough experience dealing with adversity. I'd like to pivot now to talking, Ronnie, with you about your book. I'm really excited to hear more about Memoirs of a Cold Warrior, a novel. Tell us about it. What genre of book is this? And what was the catalyst for writing it? And yeah, anything you'd like to tell us about your book?
Well, I guess the genre would be, in a literal sense, would be autofiction. Autofiction is not autobiography, but it's not completely fiction either. It's basically based upon my life. I had to jazz the novel up because my life would be so boring, nobody would want to read it, right? So what I had to do was I had to jazz things up a little bit. So when I wrote the Memoirs of a Cold Warrior, I wrote it from the standpoint of, it's basically a spy story set amongst a character that is, and I grew up being transgender and did all of the things that she could do to defeat being trans. Because when she grew up in the 50s and the 60s, she was taught that there's a very binary world. There's black, there's white, there's gay, there's straight, there's male, there's female. She didn't realize that being born male and having all of the physical attributes of a male didn't mean that she was completely male. And so, as I said, I set it in such a way to jazz everything up to keep the narrative of the story moving, because I've realized that I didn't want to write just another memoir, because I think there's enough of those out there as it is right now. And I wanted to basically put trans people in situations where they could prove that they were able to overcome through their intelligence and through their stick-to-itiveness and their resilience, as we were discussing earlier. The novel's central character is Andy, who grows up on a farm in Kansas, which tracks with Ronnie, who grew up on a farm in Kansas. Ronnie joined the military. Andy joins the military. Ronnie was trained as a cryptologic technician in the military to listen to Russian radars. Andy was trained by the military to be a counterintelligence specialist. And Andy's first job is to go to Germany, where Andy learns that he's being sent to impersonate a student at Alfred Ludwig's University in Freiburg and all of that. So he gets to be a college student, and he helps to take down the Russian spy cell. And from there, he goes out of there into college at Kansas State, falls in love with an Arab woman, and realizes that he's being unfair to her because he believes himself to be a she and is confused, but is also horribly in love with this woman, and she's in love with him. So the novel takes off from there. I won't give any other spoilers other than that, but it boils down to three parts. One part is an offering to the god of war. The other is being a spy in Europe. And the third one is basically reading the love story between character Sahela and Andy, as well as the war that happens in 1991. In fact, for the British audience, you might appreciate it. I do talk about how Andy's unit breached the Iraqi line so they could pass the British Lancers through the passage of lines, so to speak.
How long did it take you to write that memoir?
Oh, gosh. It took me a total of 3 years. I have that. I have the sequel pretty much ready to go. And the sequel is about 88,000 words, kind of like the first one is. But it basically is a sequel story to the original one.
Wow. Well, that's impressive. I just finished up my first manuscript, and I'm in the editing process right now. And I mean, just trials and tribulations dealing with writing a book. So hats off to you for getting through that whole process and getting published, really. How long has it been out now?
It's been out almost a year. It came out in late November of last year, in time for Christmas. And the sales have been steady. They've been alternatingly brisk and all of that. But what I do want to say is that I'm not sure why, but it's resonating fairly well in the Middle East. It's selling very well in Saudi Arabia, of all places.
That's so interesting. Have you been?
I know.
Have you done any?
I love seeing statistics.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Have you been invited to any events where you've been able to read from the book for an audience?
Yes, we have here in San Diego Gay Pride every year in mid-July, and I was invited by the San Diego Public Library to be an author in residence on the first day, and I was able to read to a collection of about 20 people that were just under the awning, primarily to cool off. But one woman came up to me afterwards, and she said in this very heavy Brooklyn accent, she says, "Oh my, that was so fascinating. Fascinating story." I took that night, and I just wanted to go back and say, "Oh, I want to hug you."
Is the book in different languages?
It's in English, and I'm surprised at how readily available. A lot of the sales go through Amazon right now, and people can download it immediately.
Are you wondering if the population who have shown an interest in your book are from Saudi Arabia, or are they stationed there?
I don't know those statistics. All I get is kind of a regional breakdown of where the sales are, and sales have been pretty good there. But I don't want to misinform anybody and say that they're just off the charts, because it's never going to be a bestseller. It is a niche book is what it is primarily. But what is interesting is that there's evidently interest there in Saudi Arabia, and it could be elsewhere as well. It could be also Egypt and Jordan as well.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful to hear. I'm happy that there are people that are interested in your story. I think that a lot of people within the trans community think about writing a book or think about doing a documentary, and many do, but the process to go through that and make it actually happen, it's quite complicated. So you said it took 3 years to write it. You found a publisher. How long did it take you to find a publisher and then go through the process of getting the book actually published and out to the public? What was that process like?
Well, once I signed a contract with a publisher, Transgender Press, Stephanie Castle Publications, it's an imprint of Transgender Press, it took 6 months to get the book from the signed contract stage to the actual publication and get the first books out. The book was pretty good to go because I use the Chicago Manual of Style. So I do a lot of my own self-editing and all of that. Prior to being published, I did search for regular mainstream publishers. And a lot of mainstream publishers, they wrote back and they said, this is an interesting story that we'd love to work on, but we just don't think that it's right for our agency at this time, which is kind of code word for we don't want to touch it because it's such a hot topic with a lot of people that we don't want to be canceled and all of that. And I think what happened is that a lot of people, they just don't want to touch it simply because it's so controversial in many communities here in the States.
I'm helping a playwright right now. I've been with him for the past 3 years on his memoir. He's a gay man, and it's during the drug years and the alcohol years, and he's all recovered, but he's done a hell of a job just talking about it. And he's made it, like you, he's made it very interesting. In going through the list of publishers, unfortunately, and maybe fortunately, because it helps in navigating that world to determine who really has an interest in that type of genre and who doesn't. And there are so many stipulations that it's pointless even knocking on their door, because once you read that they're only interested in one aspect of a genre, and or they want some control or say in how that manuscript is rolled out, I suppose it simplifies it. That's an interesting perspective you have. I hadn't actually thought about that. I think it's probably spot on, because people do worry about that,
right,
losing their position as a company.
For example, one of the things that I studied in school was I studied the history of South Asia. And I found out that you never want to read about Muslim history through an Indian publisher, because very often the Hindu publisher will not be fair to Islam. And vice versa. So you have to be very careful of your sources there in South Asia. But it can be done, but it almost has to be a small press. In other words, nobody that's a mainstream publisher is really going to want to touch the trans story right now, because they're all afraid of boycotts or cancellation, because it comes from both the right of society as well as the left of society, because cancellations happen on both ends of that spectrum.
If you are just joining us now, this is the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour is Veronica Zehr. Veronica is the author of Memoirs of a Cold Warrior, a novel. You can learn more about Veronica at veronicazehr.com. Veronica is currently co-chair for the San Diego LGBT Center Veterans Wall of Honor, a program honoring the military service of local LGBT citizens. We are going to take our second commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. This is Dr. Ahn with Xander Keg for the Umbrella Hour. We are meeting with Veronica Zehr. And in case you are just now picking up, We were talking about publishers, since Veronica Zira is the author of Memoirs of a Cold Warrior, a novel. Publishers might be reluctant to take on a novel about a trans woman because of the climate and all the controversies now that are circulating throughout our world. Let's pick up where we left off.
Nobody, as I said, nobody that's a mainstream publisher is really going to want to touch the trans story right now because they're all afraid of boycotts or cancellation because it comes from both the right of society as well as the left of society because cancellations happen on both ends of that spectrum. We have, what, 11 people are responsible for banning 80% of the books or something right now. We had two people here in San Diego that were checking out all of the LGBT books from public libraries and not returning them and all of that. And what they were doing was that was how they were canceling the books. Whereas Xander and I, we both know of people in the trans community here in San Diego that would cancel my book because, well, they don't like it because it's, number one, it's too militaristic. And number two, it's imperialistic because this white man falls in love with an Arab woman.
There's a third reason that they wouldn't like it, Ronnie, and that's that you are stipulating that the character is a trans woman who's has a male sex.
Yes.
So that in and of itself could get you canceled from within the, quote, left side of the trans community.
I know. I guess it's kind of nice in a way. It's almost an accolade I should embrace that I'm being canceled by both the right and the left.
Yeah. The majority of people are going more towards the middle or the center. The left wing and the right wing are small percentages within our population. So I think there is something to be able to say, because I'm the same way. I get canceled, shouted down, whatever you want to call it, from both the far right and the far left, but much more from the left than the right, which I find really interesting. I don't really understand it myself, but being in the LGBT community, I'm like, what are you upset about? But with the time that we have left, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your life. You, of course, I know you, so I know that you're married and you're living in San Diego, which is where I used to live. It's a beautiful place and you're married to a beautiful woman. And if there's anything you'd like to talk about that's a bit more on the personal side.
Well, all I can say is almost a 67-year-old woman, I would like to basically say that I'm glad I don't have children because we do have a little white small dog and Michelle and I spoil that dog so much that I'm afraid that we would produce the most entitled, spoiled child there is because we had the ASI people, the heating and cooling technicians, out yesterday, and she goes right up to them and she has a ball in her mouth and basically dropped it at their feet and said, play with me. So, yeah, we would definitely spoil the kid. I have been with Michelle now. Michelle and I have been together almost 25 years. We met in 2001. We linked up in 2002. And in fact, we really don't have a marriage anniversary date because we have so many other anniversaries in there. So we always celebrate the one that where we actually met each other. Yeah, being down here with Michelle is fully retired now and I'm retired. And we have a camper van, light-in camper that we inserted onto the back of our pickup truck. And we tool around the nation in that. So Xander, you can expect a visit from us.
I'm looking forward to that. You've been mentioning it we've been in Florida for 5 years now. And, you know, that darn COVID lockdown got in the way a little bit, but I am looking forward to that day. You know, I love it that you have so many different anniversaries. And so you celebrate the different ones. Margaret and I are the same way. We had our 21st anniversary this past September, but that anniversary is our first date anniversary. And then we also have our wedding anniversary and then our marriage anniversary because we actually didn't file the marriage license until several months after we had our wedding.
Yep.
And so we have a different date. And so we have three different anniversaries, but the primary one really is the one that recognizes our very first date. And we have gone on a date every week since that first one. It's right around or just over 1,000 dates. And so I think that's a wonderful thing for people to hear is all the different ways that we can honor and celebrate our relationships with our significant others, our partners, our spouses. I mean, anybody, but in particular, that type of relationship connection.
Yeah, well, one of the things, Michelle and I, we periodically we watch movies that we want to watch over and over sometimes. And one movie that I always get something new out of every time I see it is that movie Cloud Atlas. Cloud Atlas, I think, is a masterpiece because there's something about it that every time I see it, I see something else. And that something else, to my way of thinking, articulates how impactful that movie has been and can be to people. The movie stars Tom Hanks in about six or seven different roles, Susan Sarandon, Halle Berry, the guy that played Elrond in Lord of the Rings cycle trilogies. But it's just a wonderful movie. And it points out the tragedy of a gay love story and all of that. That's set in like the late 20s, early 30s and all of that. But there's always something about that movie I can see. It's kind of like the same way with Apocalypse Now. You can always get something else out of it every time you watch it and all of that. And to my way of thinking, that's what makes a great movie. And that's one of the things Michelle and I love to do is we love to watch old movies. And every Saturday night on Turner Classic Movies, we have to tune in to the film noir night and all of that. And sometimes we see some real laggard dogs, but by and large, it's kind of fun to watch these old B movies on Saturday night. So that's what your younger listeners have to look forward to when you turn 60. You watch old B movies.
I had a set of friends who used to refer to me as the absent-minded professor. And every year I flunk. I don't remember the anniversaries. I'm taking so much heat for it that I think now it's an obstacle. I've had to literally text my partner's daughter to say, hey, do you remember the date? And then she'll tell me the date. I'm on good terms, but sometimes I'm past the date. Oh, it was. It's like, okay. Yeah. So, well, kudos to both of you.
Well, you know, nowadays with technology, I put everything on my Google Calendar and it sends me a little notification. It reminds me of things because as you get older and older, I mean, we can't really rely on our memories as much. Hopefully at this point, when we forget things, it can be just a good laugh between two people. Because I think after you've been in relationships for 20 years or more, if it's a good relationship, and I think people know the difference, then the partners understand that it's the day-to-day stuff that really matters more than remembering a special day, I would hope. The one that remembers, Margaret doesn't remember the dates all the time like I do. So it's interesting most people think it's the flip, you know, in say a standard heterosexual marriage, it's the wife that remembers, but not the husband. And so as a trans man, I am the husband, but I do remember. So, but it's like, it doesn't necessarily mean that it could be very different. I mean, like on, right? It could be different.
You remind me of my son, Ari. He's a walking encyclopedia. He remembers dates and places. It's wonderful.
It is an occupational hazard. Being a social worker, I really am. I refer to myself as a walking encyclopedia. Every time I meet with somebody, even if it's just for like 30 minutes, they always say, wow, I'm walking away with so many resources. And I'm like, oh yeah, I should have warned you that if you're going to have a conversation with me, you need to take notes because I'm going to say book titles and websites and organizational names. And sorry, overload, you know. Well, Ronnie, it's been so wonderful talking with you. It's been a little while since we've actually had a conversation. And so I'm so happy that we were able to have it on the podcast together today. It was wonderful seeing you. And for the audience, you're hearing us talk, but we're actually on Zoom together right now. And so we can see each other. So it's lovely to be able to see you. And I'm looking forward to when you are driving that trailer across the country to see me here in Florida. And it's wonderful to have you on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close up?
No, Xander, I just wanted to thank you and Dr. On for having me here. I really got energized about this and I think it was a wonderful experience. So thank you so much for letting me plug my book and thank you for all of your questions and also thank you for your insights.
It was a pleasure. It was really wonderful meeting you.
Thank you.
And again, the book is Memoirs of a Cold Warrior, a Novel by Veronica Zerr. It's spelled Z-E-R-R-E-R.
It's available where any fine books are sold. You can get it through Barnes & Noble here in the States. And I imagine, I don't know the publisher, I don't know the big house in the UK, but I imagine that you can get it through there too.
We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour was Veronica Zerr. We hope you will join us next time. Thank you for listening.
wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod. This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.